From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Schizophrenia is not well understood.
I think schizophrenia is a very scary mental disorder to have because you lose touch with reality. I live every day with the fear that I'm going to go crazy, or that I'm going to get stuck in a hallucination.
The myths and truths about living with schizophrenia, we'll break it down. But first, yesterday we talked about a free dental clinic in Lawrenceville that'll happen this weekend. Georgia Health News editor Andy Miller said the demand for care like that is pretty high.
People stand in line early in the morning to get in line for the free care. It's something that people kind of ignore sometimes when they shouldn't. And then something gets painful and then they need the care right then. I think it's an access to care issue, but I also think it's somewhat of a cost issue as well.
Here are your first thoughts. Cheryl Reeves tweets, just listen now, enlightening. Gainesville has done something like this for many years, not sure if they still do. Metro Cola points out, only one dental school in Georgia causing statewide dentist shortage. Why can't Columbus State have a doctoral dental school? And Drew Hook says the last time he saw a dentist was last year before I lost my dental insurance because I couldn't afford it. We always love to get your thoughts, so call us at 404-500-9457 and leave a message. We're also on Twitter. It's at OST Talk, or post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. This weekend's One Music Festival in Atlanta will bring about the reunion of a local hip-hop collective called the Dungeon Family. Its members include Outkast, CeeLo Green, and Goody Mob. The production company behind a lot of their music is Organized Noise. Last year, I spoke with music producer Ray Murray of Organized Noise about whether his group set out to create a distinct Southern sound.
Well, you know, it was a process of trial and error, because in the beginning, you know, it was just about fitting in more so than standing out or trying to lead. But eventually, we came to the realization from studying New York hip-hop and West Coast hip-hop that what really identified it and personified it was its sense of self and the way that it brought across its identity. So whereas in East Coast hip-hop, you have the identification of boroughs, you know what I mean, and zones, and each borough and zone has a dialect. On the West Coast, you would have the same thing. We just didn't know it until we studied a little bit and found out the differences in Oakland and Los Angeles, San Diego, you know what I mean? So we then said, okay, well, let's do the same thing here. Instead of emulating the East Coast or the West Coast, let's do Atlanta, and let's bring off Southwest Atlanta draw, the slang, you know, every little nuance that is the South and definitely Atlanta. And we did that, and you know, it was received pretty good, because we are here today, you know.
Let me play you this clip from Rico Wade. He's talking about this very thing that you're talking about here.
New York is very influential to Southern hip-hop. New York is the father. It's the father of it. It's like me and my partner, Ray, we studied hip-hop. Like, went to New York, went to Harlem, went to the Bronx, went to certain places to get breakbeats and stuff, because when I first heard Eric B. and Rakim, when I first heard KRS-One, it was around that time when Criminal Minded was out, Paid in Full, Slick Rick. I just loved them cats, man. I don't know why, man. I mean, they were speaking truth. It was like my first time riding in a car or something. Like, when I'm as a youth, riding in a car with your friend. No, it's like your teenage year, you can't drive, your buddy stole his mama car. And y'all ride out the night, and we riding to Rakim. I ain't no joke. So like some crazy reason it stuck with me, and a lot of his music was James Brown inspired. Like I didn't think it wasn't original. I was thinking like, look where they got this from.
So let's talk about the very last thing he said. It sounds like he's saying, I didn't think they were stealing from the South. They were being influenced by the South. What's your feeling on that, about those who were sampling Southern music and weren't in and of the South?
Well, it from his point of view, just in referencing Rakim and all of that,
yeah.
I don't think that there was ever any belief that anyone was stealing anything from the South, if it was conveyed that way. I don't think that that was the point. I think that the realization that a lot of the artists that East Coast hip-hop as well as West Coast hip-hop was sampling were, you know, Black artists, you know, particularly from maybe southern parts of the the United States. But it wasn't necessarily, it wasn't ever a feeling of theft or, you know, someone stealing something from us. It was more of a, how do I get to that point? You know what I mean? How do I get there?
And I asked Ray Murray what he thought about the future of hip hop in the South.
I wish I could speak as the captain of hip hop for the South in Atlanta, but as merely a player on the team of, you know, all the participants, I would hope that, well, just by our maturity, you know what I mean? The same thing that has gone on in New York in its maturity, its acceptance of other regions.
Yeah.
There used to be a very distinct battle line drawn between
people
the
died.
East, the West.
Yeah.
Not necessarily in that
part.
Distinct, but just in the creative part.
Right.
You know what I mean? So there was a battle between the East and the West and the South. It is gone. It has matured.
And become unified.
It's become unified.
That was a portion of my conversation last year with Ray Murray, one of the producers behind Atlanta hip-hop production team, Organized Noise. The company reunites with Atlanta hip-hop collective, the Dungeon Family, at the One Music Fest in Atlanta. And joining them this weekend is Atlanta rapper Killer Mike. He often infuses messages of social injustice into his music. This past year, when he was not recording his next album, he spent time stumping for Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders. We asked him to take a break from both of those by picking two of his favorite songs that were written or performed by another Georgian. Here are Killer Mike's additions to our essential Georgia playlist.
The first song that I'm going to pick that I like by a Georgia artist is They Don't Dance No More by Goody Mob. Goody Mob and Atlanta had been kind of put in a place of, you're Miami Part 2. You're not quite Uncle Luke or DJ Magic Mike out of Orlando. You're like, you guys are pretty good at the dance music. You know, it was like Scrub the Ground and Whoop That Is. And those kind of fun dance records were dominating, but Goody were saying things, you know what I'm saying? And they put it over a beat that you could juke to and groove to and afterwards, you know, talk about. So for me, you know, it was just that they moved your mind and your booty. They, you know, they made the top half and the bottom half shake. That record from Goody is one of my favorites because it not only was a dope rap record, it was an amazingly good dance record that I traveled through all the, you know, the 559s, the Gates, you know, just those type of clubs that college kids were going to. It was that juke that was in 559. It was the juke joint. It was the sweaty Chitlin circuit moving. And it really helped me, that record really helped me understand what now Run the Jewels is. You know, we are a group that could be considered heavy, that could be considered intense, but our shows are fun. People are moshing, but they're smiling. They're wilding, but they're dancing. There's a fevered exhausting of energy that needed to get burned off. And I understood about Goody that I needed those records from them as much as I needed soul food, as much as I needed In the Ghetto, as much as I needed those records to get me through anger and pain. I needed celebratory records from artists I loved. So that's one of them. And I don't think Goody Mob is as heralded as they should be. The second song I like to pick is the Allman Brothers, Whipping Post. I'll smoke a joint at the crib and just watch a whole hour of Allman Brothers or listen to them. They did a festival here, but I listen to that whole performance at least once or twice a week. I
You know, I've been run down. I've been lied to. I don't know why. You know, I let that mean woman make a fool. She took all my money, wrecked my new car, and now she's with one of my good time buddies. They're drinking at some crosstown bar. If you're, first of all, if you're Southern, you know what a whipping post is. If that's not the blues, what is? Like, as a man, you know, I like to feel like I've been an alpha male in every relationship. And, man, if my wife left me the day, I'd be curled up in a corner, you know, crying. You know what I'm saying? And I know, you know, as a man, you don't know what it feels like to hurt till you've been heartbroken, man. You know, and the blues let you know that. Like, think about it. When you hear, sometimes I feel, you know, like I've been tied to the whipping post. Good Lord, I feel like I'm dying. I felt like that. Me and my wife went through a hard part. You know, she wasn't a woman running around on me. You know, I made some wrong decisions at some point in our marriage, and, man, she put me out. That might have been the worst year of my life. Allman Brothers is just what I play, man, to kind of get me in the mood before a show. Before I go on stage and rap, I'm probably going to play some Allman Brothers or some Zeppelin or some Sabbath. You know, those guys aren't from Georgia, but I feel like they were influenced by the blues, so I had to say it. But the Allman Brothers, they're just amazing. Every time I go through Macon, my wife's from Savannah, every time we hit the Macon line, Allman Brothers comes on. Like, I'm playing it. You know, I'm playing it till we get all the way down 16. Is there a sound that defines Georgia? Yeah, it's called Organized Noise Productions. If you want to hear what Georgia was, what Georgia is, and what Georgia can and will be, you're talking about music and instrumentation. You're talking about lyricisms that have grain and grit to them. You're talking about the Dungeon Family. You're talking about Organized Noise. Because you're going to hear the South. You're going to hear soul in the music. You're going to hear Curtis Mayfield. You're going to hear Little Richard. You're going to hear James Brown. You're going to hear Dre, Big, you know, me, CeeLo. And I don't mean just mean the literal. You're going to hear Future. You know, you're going to, you know, all the people I'm naming are members of the Dungeon Family, you know, in terms of the rappers. It's like, it's just a soul, man. You can't even describe it. It's just literally just a soul. Like, I can't tell you why Wu-Tang Clan is so much better than so many other groups who tried to be them. They got it. Whatever that soul is, they got it. And, you know, whatever the soul is that Dungeon Family had and helped impart on me, I'm happy for it, because it really does give you a sense of what Georgia feels like.
That was Atlanta rapper Killer Mike with his two picks for our Georgia playlist. He'll join other members of the Dungeon Family this weekend at One Music Fest in Atlanta. Just ahead, what exactly is schizophrenia and how do we treat it? First, though, we'll talk about diversity with a cast member from In the Heights. This is on Second Thought. Before Lin-Manuel Miranda cast a diverse group of actors as America's founding fathers in Hamilton, he wrote In the Heights. It's a musical that focuses on New York City's Washington Heights neighborhood.
It's getting mad expensive, but we live with just enough.
In the Heights, I live in the Heights and start my day.
A production of In the Heights from Theatrical Outfit will come to Atlanta's Rialto Center for the Arts tonight. And Julissa Sabino is one of the stars. Julissa joins me now. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Chad Darnell joined us again, a casting director whose work includes Selma, Magic Mike XXL, and the PBS period drama Mercy Street, among many others. He's also an actor, producer, and writer. Chad, it's good to have you back.
Good to have. Good to be here. Thank you for having me.
Joining us from GPB in Savannah. Julius, I want to first make sure people know what In the Heights was.
Yes.
Is because this is a musical. Many people have just been introduced to Lin-Manuel Miranda, but In the Heights was nominated for 13 Tony Awards. It won four. It was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. Can you give us a 2-sentence summary of the plot?
Yeah, absolutely. So it focuses on the Washington Heights community in New York, and it's really about a universal story about finding home and what that means to you, and sometimes whether you're going to continue on with the traditions that have been established by your family and find your own path, and how you can keep your tradition and still move on into your future.
Important that it's called In the Heights because Washington Heights has a large population of Dominican Americans, many of them first generation children of immigrants. And the cast that you are with is very multiracial.
Yes, yes. I think we're actually completely diverse. I don't think anybody in the cast is just completely one race. So I think everyone is a minority. There's not a single white person in our cast. Every single person in our cast is a diverse person of a community.
So, Chad, here's the thing. We have heard a lot about the lack of diversity in Hollywood. That continues. But the Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright Lynn Nottage, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, I've only ever read it, has described theater as, quote, the last bastion of segregation. Why is, with the huge diversity of people that want to be in theater, why is this still a problem in live theater?
It's in theater?
Yeah.
Why is it a problem in theater? Well, with theater, I think that we have people that are, if you're going to go spend a lot of money for a theater, because theater is expensive, especially in New York.
Yeah.
If you're going to spend that much money, you're open to the idea of watching individuals of different races playing these characters. You're more open-minded is what I'm trying to say. There seems to be a lot more open-minded opportunities, especially like with this production in Atlanta and with Hamilton on Broadway right now. I think that we're moving more into a space where casting directors in theater are open to diversity casting, whereas in the past it's not been that way at all.
So you're saying we might be seeing a change coming.
I definitely see a change, especially because, you know, where I'm seeing it is in Hollywood. There's always so much talk about casting an actor, and I think a lot of times we're quick to jump on an actor like this Matt Damon movie that came up recently, The Great Wall.
Yeah.
Immediately it was all over Twitter, like, how could they cast Matt Damon in this movie, because it's an action adventure set in the Great Wall, and
he is very much not Chinese.
He's very much not Chinese. However, you know, we all did the pile on. It's like, how could you cast Matt Damon? It's like, well, he's not even playing a character who was supposed to be Chinese. He's playing a white character, and even the director came out to say, no, that was not what was happening at all. Yet there are like movies like Ghost in the Shell, when Scarlett Johansson was cast, and that character based on the comics was definitely not a white chick. And so it's always, for Hollywood, it's always going to come down to a dollar sign. Can they get butts in seats?
Yeah.
And a lot of times it's going to come with hiring a Scarlett Johansson.
Okay, so then let's talk about theater.
Right.
Yes.
Because the Atlantic Lyric Theater got in a lot of trouble for casting mostly white people as the Puerto Ricans in West Side Story. They have since apologized for that
yes,
and said that was a mistake. But that's not the only thing. We've got Chicago's Marriott Theater. They cast almost no actors of Latin heritage in a production of Evita. This is and Lin-Manuel Miranda himself took a lot of heat for putting out a casting call for Hamilton asking for no white actors.
Right.
So
right.
How do we, if Hollywood is its own thing and it's looking for money, is that the same problem, Julissa, in theater?
I feel like it's more an issue of, for an actor, when we get an audition notice, it is specifically stated almost always what race they're looking for in terms of characters. Now, that's not necessarily, and I think that was more just before. For example, like A Chorus Line, shows like that, there are characters in it that are not stated whether they need to be Caucasian or African-American or Hispanic or Asian. It can be anybody. But I think there is an idea that people have that it should be this way because it's been this way before. So I think the problem is that they continue to call on white actors more frequently for roles that have been played by white actors in the past instead of thinking outside of the box and thinking, well, this character is not specific. This show isn't race specific. This character's struggle isn't race specific. So let me call upon all of the races to audition for this role. I think that's more where the theater needs to expand their horizons.
So Chad, I completely agree.
Go ahead.
And especially with some of the properties that are coming up, like American Idiot recently.
Right.
Based on Green Day's album,
yep.
Yes. I've seen about a half dozen versions of it over the past 2 years. And in each version, the character of St. Jimmy has been either male or female, black or white. Same thing with What's-Her-Name. When they did it on Broadway, she was an African-American female, but I have seen it with all different races as well. So I think that the theater community has always been ahead of the curve, I believe, when it comes to blind casting is what we used to call it.
Right.
And I think with properties like Hamilton, like In the Heights, we definitely want to see more of our community. We want to see different. We want to see
something that looks a little bit more like the actual demographics of America.
Right.
Absolutely.
Okay, so let me give you both a little pushback. NPR's Weekend Edition spoke with a number of Academy members after the furor over Oscar So White. So here's David Kilpatrick. He is white. He's the former president of Paramount Motion Pictures Group. And here he is speaking about this issue.
What I'm against is the Academy's sort of hasty decision to sort of obliterate the old folks inside the Academy, as if it was some kind of white man's cabal who voted, you know, these people in. And by the way, I guess I would be part of that.
He would definitely be part of that. Let me add one more before we get your response. Here is screenwriter and producer Patricia Resnick. She wrote the film 9 to 5, among a number of other things, also speaking on Weekend Edition back in February.
The Academy is not meant to reflect the diversity in America. The Academy is meant to be a reflection of the best of the business. The business is too white and too male.
So, Chad, okay, there she is saying that the part that it's not really about diversity in casting. The problem is higher up.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think of that?
I personally, having been in too many conversations, with big blockbusters like Magic Mike and very small $1 million independents, it's always coming down to money. I've never been in a conversation with a producer or a studio head where it's like, no, we're white, we're going to have a white person doing this. It's always come down to a dollar sign.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether it's about race or also at this situation recently with Matt Bomer, where he was hired to play a trans character and the entire trans community was in an uproar. It's like, why didn't you hire a trans actor? We need to have conversations, much like this Oscar So White and the opening up of the Academy and inviting more members into the Academy who are not white or are not just white. I think that conversations need to be happening. However, I think that these conversations need to have respect on all levels. The first guy that you had playing on there, it sounds a little, get off my lawn.
That would be David Kilpatrick.
He a little aggressive there. But these are conversations that we need to be having, and we need to go in them with respect on all sides and really listening to people.
Yeah, I mean, I can hear in your voice how conflicted and complicated this issue is. And I should mention that they have new research out showing that actually diversity hasn't gotten better in Hollywood. Lesbian, gay, or transgender characters account for less than 1% of speaking roles.
Yeah.
But here's the pushback, Jalissa. Why, if you're having colorblind casting, then we shouldn't complain if a white person plays a person of color, right? I mean, that would mean that you're not paying attention to somebody's color.
So I think that is true if it is a character in a story that is not about a specific struggle. I think, and theater, of course, is very creative and very freeing. So I think if it depends on how it's marketed, and if you're saying, hey, we're doing this and we know that we're doing this, we know that we're putting white people in this African-American role, but we're doing it with a purpose, so please come see our show. I still think that can be impactful with purpose. But I think when a story is specifically about a race, and there are plenty of actors of that race available with talent to portray it truthfully and honestly and genuinely, yeah. then I think it should stay mm-hmm. that way. Like, right. I would feel offended if a completely white cast did Fences.
Do you know what I mean? Right. Fences, right. So then let me put this to you, because I actually read a comment, Chad, where they said, look, if Condoleezza Rashad can play Juliet, then why can't a white person play Maria in West Side Story? What's your response?
I'm like Jalissa. I believe that if it's set in Puerto, if you're portraying characters that are from Puerto Rico, you should not have a white. That's just my opinion, though. That's just me as a producer. I would never have an all white cast of West Side Story, because that's not what the story is about. And I think that you're offending. And I think that that's, again, having these conversations, that to me seems clearly that you're going to offend an entire race of people by trying to say, oh, this is who we're casting here. I had not heard about that casting. Sorry, I missed that one. But again, here on the flip side of that, recently the new Spider-Man movie, they cast Zendaya as Mary Jane.
Yeah, who's African-American.
Who is definitely not white.
Yeah, we'll have to end that here. Chad Darnell is actor, producer, and casting director. Julissa Sabino is one of the stars of Theatrical Outfit's production of In the Heights. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks. And break leg tonight.
Thank you so much.
In the Heights opens tonight at the Rialto Center for the Arts in Atlanta. It runs through September 18th.
Carnaval del barrio. Carnaval.
Carnaval
del barrio.
Barrio.
Carnaval.
Carnaval
del barrio.
Barrio.
We don't need electricidad. Get off your butt, avanza. Saca la maraca, bring your tambourine. Come and join the parranda.
Epa.
Carnaval.
You might not guess it from old westerns, but many of the bull riders and cattle ropers of the world are people of color. African Americans, Latinos, and Native Americans played a key role in the settlement of the American West and the development of rodeo. As GPB's Emily Jones reports, special rodeos in Georgia and around the country highlight that history and aim to bring new fans of color into the sport.
It's the first trip to the rodeo for Ramona Famble and her friends Toy Denson and Rashima Johnson. And they don't quite know the rules yet.
That rope has to break before the horse goes, and that horse broke the rope.
Yeah, but I think they time it.
Okay.
Even though they're not experts, they're enjoying the show.
Like, not knowing what to expect, and then you saw the first guy go out, and he, like, tackles this bull, and he, like, jumps on him, and he rolls around in the dirt. You know, I'm like, wow.
They're enjoying the view, too.
Hi, cowboy!
These women didn't know about black rodeos until one came to Savannah, where they live. And that's fairly common. Keith Roberts founded the Atlanta Black Rodeo Association in 1991. He says he wanted to spread the word about cowboys of color.
A lot of the African-American community doesn't know about black cowboys, and so that was one way to educate them and entertain them at the same time. And if you go to regular rodeo, you don't see a lot of blacks at regular rodeo. So we gave them a venue where they come out and feel comfortable.
That question of comfort is a big reason why black rodeos, as well as Latino and Native American rodeos, are still around today, more than half a century after integration ended baseball's Negro Leagues. Tracy Owens Patton from the University of Wyoming wrote a book about ethnicity and rodeo. She says the professional league itself was never officially segregated, but separate rodeos cropped up as Jim Crow laws kept riders of color out of venues. And now?
rodeo has been slow, I would argue, in just feeling like a welcoming place to some of the rodeo participants.
Keith Roberts says he never faced overt exclusion when he was a rider, but he says it's still tough to draw new fans of color to rodeo.
You know, if you're from Atlanta and you're going out to a small town, you don't feel comfortable. And it's not that you're excluded, it's just you don't feel comfortable.
Creating a rodeo where those fans do feel welcome can pay off big time. Robert says his rodeos bring in between 2,000 and 5,000 people, depending on the arena. And once they're sold on the sport, many come back over and over. The Black Rodeo in Savannah certainly converted a few new fans, like Rashima Johnson.
This is my first time. Such an awesome event. Definitely, definitely worth it.
For GPB News, I'm Emily Jones in Savannah.
Coming up next, how well do you understand schizophrenia? Do you know what it really is? We'll explain. This is On Second Thought. Do people with disabilities need their own pride movement? Tomorrow we hear from an Emory professor of disability studies about what it means to be disabled. And we want to know what you think. Are disabilities embraced as much as they should be? And if not, why not? Call us at 404-500-9457 to be part of that discussion, and then be sure to join us tomorrow for more. Georgia Tech researchers hope to get a clearer picture of what schizophrenia does to the brain. Two biomedical engineers there have developed a tool that could simulate the brain's reaction to schizophrenia. Avard Voigt says this project looks at short-term memory loss for people with the condition.
Well, you cannot plan your life. You start doing something and then you don't know why you started doing it. So you do something else. You don't know what to do with the scissor. You put it somewhere else and forget about it. You expose yourself to harm if you don't know what you're doing. You may run into a street or do something, and you don't know why you did it and how you did it and how you got there.
Voigt says this research will not lead to a cure for schizophrenia. But his colleague at Georgia Tech, Zen Chi, says it could lead to medical breakthroughs in treating short-term memory loss for those who have schizophrenia.
So you have better understanding from systematic point of view of the phenomena. Then you have better chance to find appropriate drugs for this to cure or to treat or even cure the disease.
About 1% of Americans live with schizophrenia. That means it's not rare, but it's not as common as depression, say. Schizophrenia is more common in movies and TV than it is in real life. So for some of us, what we know about the disorder mostly comes from the silver screen. And you know, when a word is heard a lot but not well understood, it's time to break it down. Let's talk first about what schizophrenia is not, because there are a lot of myths out there. First of all, schizophrenia is not curable, but it is very treatable. Gone are the days when a schizophrenic was institutionalized for life.
You are not crazy.
And what's wrong with me?
Tell me, Dr. Val, what's your diagnosis?
The medical community has access to a lot of resources, including rehabilitation and medication. So someone who has this disorder can live a perfectly normal, healthy life.
He's going to get through this thing okay, isn't he?
Life is a cookie.
I'm going to take that as a yes.
Okay, here's another myth about schizophrenia. Remember the classic film, Sybil?
I used to think that everybody was like this, that they would just naturally wake up and be someplace else or a whole lot older or wearing another dress.
Many people think schizophrenics have multiple personalities. In fact, the National Alliance on Mental Illness conducted a survey in 2008. They found 64% of people think schizophrenia involves split personalities. It does not. No one is sure where this misconception began, but it might have come from the name of the disorder. Schizo means split. But in this usage, it refers to a split in perception or thinking, not a split personality. If you have multiple personalities, you suffer from dissociative identity disorder. Get it?
I think she's got it. I think she's got it. By George, she's got it. By George, she's got it.
Myth number three, schizophrenics are dangerous. There is a personality disorder that's associated with lack of empathy, deceit, and criminal behavior. But it's called psychopathy, not schizophrenia.
And even so, psychopaths aren't usually violent, and the most violent criminals are not usually psychopaths.
On the next Dr. Oz, everybody wants to know, am I normal or nuts? Should you be worried?
This behavior is... it's not normal.
Have you gone completely insane? I mean, sir, have you gone completely insane? Completely insane people go outside, suck on a rock, and bark at the moon.
It's best to stop thinking of criminals as people that suffer from mental illness. That's a really common myth, but it is a myth all the same.
These shootings, we have people who have mental disturbances.
Do we need to do a better job in mental health? You bet we do.
Only 5% or less of violent acts are committed by people with mental illness. And they're actually 10 times more likely to be victims of violent crime than the general population. Hollywood really doesn't help here. There's a long list of movies that feature characters with schizophrenia who become violent. Black Swan.
There's always an alternate. Lily's the best choice.
No, but she wants my role.
Every dancer in the world wants your role.
No, this is different. She's after me. She's trying to replace me.
Nobody's after you.
Shutter Island.
Are you real?
No. She's still here.
Ooh.
Even Jason Voorhees from Friday the 13th supposedly has schizophrenia.
Jason was my son, and today is his birthday. Oh, my sweet, innocent Jason. My only child.
And here's another myth. A serious mental illness is triggered by trauma. Take, for example, the movie The Fisher King with Robin Williams. Psychologists say Williams did a good job of portraying a schizophrenic.
Do you know who I am?
I'm drawing a blank.
Well, take a guess. Let him guess.
Some kind of vigilante?
Well, that happens along the way, of course. But here's a clue. I'm a knight.
But in the film, his illness is triggered by the violent death of his fiancée. That event would not cause schizophrenia. And just to be clear, bad parenting doesn't cause it any more than good parenting prevents it. So now that we've established what it isn't, let's talk about what schizophrenia is. It's a disorder of the brain. It is chronic, and more than 200,000 cases are diagnosed every year. Schizophrenia affects the way a person interacts with reality. Someone might have hallucinations or delusions. They might have agitated body movements. They may have very little emotional expression in their voice or face. They may have trouble focusing. They may have trouble remembering things they've just learned. We don't actually know what causes schizophrenia, but there are some risk factors. First of all, it tends to run in families, but not always. Schizophrenia might be related to genetics, but there's no single gene that determines if someone will have it or not. The disorder could be influenced by environment, too. Complications during birth or exposure to viruses, for example. A lot of people with schizophrenia first experience symptoms during their teen years. So puberty might affect risk, but we don't know. The cause of this disorder remains a medical mystery. But it's no mystery that schizophrenia is a serious disorder. We know that. And we also know now that it's eminently treatable. There's no need to fear anyone with schizophrenia.
Fear leads to anger. Anger leads to hate. Hate leads to suffering.
So those are the basics of schizophrenia. Now let's get more specific information from an expert. Our expert is Robert Coates, an assistant professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Emory University. He studies schizophrenia. It's good to have you with us. Thanks, Robert.
Thanks so much for having me.
So this new research, we're talking about this because there's this new technology from Georgia Tech, which helps us simulate schizophrenia, the effect of schizophrenia on the brain. Why would that be helpful?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm really excited about the work that Dr. Voigt has done. Essentially, what he's done is he's taken a lot of existing research studies and he's tried to understand the way that different neurotransmitters interact with each other in the brain. It's a very complicated system that they've tried to make in something that's pretty easy to understand. I think it has a lot of applications for potentially developing new ways to treat this disorder. And also, it may have some implications to help people better understand, like people in the lay public or medical students or other people, to understand exactly how these different neurotransmitters interact with each other.
Why do we have difficulty tracing the effects of schizophrenia on the brain? Why has it, it's 2016, why has it taken us so long to see that?
Well, it's an incredibly complicated disorder that involves a lot of different things going on at the brain at the same time. So as the clip before mentioned, there's a genetic component. There's a way that different neurotransmitters interact with each other. There's a way that different brain areas actually connect with each other that may have an impairment. And then there's just the intersection of each individual and how they can experience this disorder. So there's all kinds of variables that are all very complicated. As you know, there's no single test that's used to diagnose schizophrenia. There's no brain
test,
no blood
test. Right, I read
that,
but I don't think people realize this. You can't go into a doctor and just have them run a test and say, okay, you're a schizophrenic. How many tests does somebody need to run before they're diagnosed?
So that's a great question. Typically, when we first see someone who has symptoms of psychosis, we look at a number of things that could cause psychosis from a medical perspective. There are some infections, there's some autoimmune conditions, there's some lesions in the brain that can actually mimic psychosis, the kind of psychosis that people with schizophrenia experience. So the first thing we do is rule out any medical conditions that could be causing this.
Yeah. And then you have to go through to find exactly what is going wrong, right? Are they having hallucinations? Are they what's happening that's causing them to feel unwell, right?
Exactly.
Okay. So the reason we don't have a cure for schizophrenia so far and the reason we only have treatment is what?
Well, I think that we haven't exactly been able to identify one common theme of dysfunction in the brain with individuals with schizophrenia.
There's no smoking gun.
There's no smoking gun. There's no single target that we can really say, okay, this is what it is.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Robert Coates. He's an assistant professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Emory University. And we're talking about some advances in technology related to schizophrenia and what they may be able to do. So if the reason we haven't been able to cure it before or even find a pill that really just treats it, right? If that the reason for that is because we don't know the cause, then possibly this new technology, which helps us see what's happening in the brain, could really lead to some breakthroughs, could it not?
Yes, I think there's a lot of optimism about it. I think that another big challenge is that we are making the assumption that schizophrenia has all the same cause, when in fact it may actually be different disorders that maybe we just haven't exactly figured out how to identify.
It could be a cluster of things.
Right, exactly.
All right, so then why do you think there is so many misconceptions about schizophrenia? Why do people so misunderstand this illness?
There's so much stigma about schizophrenia that really makes it more challenging. So I think that there's been a lot of perceptions in the media about what schizophrenia is or is not. That's one of the major challenges, I think, is the stigma.
Does that complicate treatment of it because people themselves have accepted that stigma?
Oh, I think any individual who's experiencing symptoms of psychosis, I think the last thing, I think it's very difficult to acknowledge that one has a mental illness such as schizophrenia. And in fact, we've even looked at the challenges that people have to recognize that they have psychotic symptoms as a symptom of the illness itself.
Right. You don't even realize that something's going wrong.
Right.
So does that mean that schizophrenia is often diagnosed based on a family member or loved one coming in and raising red flags?
Sure. It can be a family member or a loved one. And also the individual can be very fearful or have concerns about things that are going on around them. And sometimes they can come to treatment themselves.
Okay, so what is our, I mean, other than a cause, if there is a single cause, which it sounds like there is not, what are some of the big questions that you have about schizophrenia that might help in treatment?
So some of the biggest questions I have are, we've become very interested in looking at people who don't respond very well to the current medication treatments that we have. So we've been studying...
They have schizophrenia, but the drugs that we use to treat schizophrenia normally don't help them.
Right. That happens to about 30% of people with schizophrenia.
Holy cow. That's a lot.
They don't have all that great of responses to medication, especially the... So those are people who don't respond well to the hallucinations and the delusions type symptoms. But there's actually the other symptoms, like the negative symptoms and the cognitive symptoms of schizophrenia. They don't really respond very well to medication at all at this point.
What symptoms are those? What does a negative or cognitive symptom look like?
So a negative symptom has to do with things like motivation, things like maybe someone has a restricted facial range, or maybe they have speech that's less than what, you know, they're
not
pretty
emotional.
Terse.
Yes. Yeah. So lack of motivation, they don't want to get out of bed in the morning, right?
Right. It's hard to find the drive.
Right. And then their face and their speech, they sound monotone and their face can look blank.
Exactly.
And I imagine, I mean, this is coming from someone who has zero background in clinical psychology, but I imagine sometimes that can be mistaken for depression.
Oh, yes. Yes.
So even the diagnosis of schizophrenia can be difficult.
Absolutely.
And you were about to, earlier, you were going to tell me the litany of tests that sometimes have, the battery of tests that somebody might have to go through in order to get that diagnosis. What kind of tests do you run?
So usually we do a number of tests. We look at markers of infection in the body. We do tests for sexually transmitted infections. Sometimes we would check like a test for HIV. We would test it. We would do a test for something like neurosyphilis, which can often look like schizophrenia. We also look at people's thyroid function. We often do a brain scan, like a CT scan or an MRI
scan. Yeah, you're looking for those
scan.
Lesions you mentioned. You're basically trying to rule stuff out.
Exactly.
And in the end, once you've ruled everything out, you're left with schizophrenia.
Right. And I think it's also important to know that psychosis is a symptom of schizophrenia, but there can be many causes of psychosis.
I see. It's a complicated issue, and it's no surprise that people don't entirely understand it. Robert Coates is an assistant professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Emory University. Robert, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
That is our show for today, but tell us what you need to have explained, maybe. Maybe there's a word or phrase that lots of people use incorrectly or something that you think people don't really understand. Let us know so we can maybe explain it. Call us at 404-500-9457 and leave your message. We're also on Twitter. I'm at Celeste Headley. The show is at OST Talk, or you can post to facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio. For today, that is On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.